It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, what new EPA rules limiting carbon emissions from energy producers are going to mean for Wisconsin coal plants.
First, a new study released last week comes to a startling conclusion about the future of plants and animals on the planet. Species are becoming extinct at least 1,000 times faster than they did before humans arrived on the scene, and the world could be on the brink of a sixth great extinction.
It's a wake-up call for biologists and citizens alike, but with so many species on the proverbial chopping block, where do we even start when it comes to conservation efforts? Can this trend be reversed or at least slowed down?
We've got the lead author of that study with us now. Stuart Pym is a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, where he studies present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them. Stuart, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much indeed.
Well, let's talk about this finding. Species are becoming extinct at least 1,000 times faster than they did before humans arrived on the scene. As someone who studies extinctions, how alarming is this to you?
Well, it's worse than we thought. We had originally done calculations that suggested a somewhat slower rate. But it's a lot of species going extinct, and if it continues for decades to come, it means that we will pass on to our children and our grandchildren a very seriously depleted world, and I think that would be a considerable tragedy.
And this is higher, as you mentioned, than previously thought. What are some of the main factors driving this rapid rate of extinction?
There are probably three major causes that we talked about. One of them is habitat destruction. We are chopping a lot of the world's habitats down, particularly forests, particularly tropical forests, but boreal forests too. We are warming the planet so that it's getting warmer, and that means species have to go further north or higher up on mountains. And we're also, particularly in the oceans, being very careless in how we exploit species there. We're driving many species to the brink of extinction by not managing those resources well. I think those are three of the sort of the major causes.
And you've got this 1,000 times faster than they did before humans arrived number out there. How did you get there?
Well, you know, this is a death rate. And it's rather like saying, well, you know, how many people dying in Madison, Wisconsin? Is that a safe place to be? And we calculate that death rate by looking at a few thousand people and following them for a year and seeing how many obituaries appeared in the newspaper. That's what we do with species. We follow them rather longer. We follow them for a decade or maybe 50 years, and we look at how many species have expired in that period. And that gives us the current death rate. And then we can sort of say, well, what should the death rate be? What would it have been like before humans were on the scene? And the fossil record is helpful for that. And also, incidentally, molecular data from sort of DNA. We can work out how long species take to make new species, and that process of birth and death gives us a timeline for what the sort of the natural process of extinction should be. And what we find is that species are going extinct about 1,000 times faster than they should be.
And we've heard, including from a guest on this show in the past, that we may be on the brink of an extinction event, the sixth great extinction, usually brought about by really bad things, lots of volcanoes, possible meteor impacts, that sort of thing. Do you agree? Are we approaching that kind of scale of mass extinction?
Yes, we are. I mean, it's not a term I particularly like, but it does capture the people's imagination. I mean, the last big event was the number five, which was about 60 million years ago, when an asteroid plowed into present-day Yucatan in Mexico and pretty much sterilized all of North America. The scale of that, it was the event that eliminated the dinosaurs. The scale of that event is sort of comparable to what we're doing now. We could wipe out a third, maybe even half of all the species on Earth. I think that's something that we need to do something to prevent. And, the alarming news in the paper was up front, but the main thrust of the paper that we published in last Friday's journal Science was talking about the things we can do about it and how we can work out where species are and how we can act sensibly to prevent extinctions.
Is that why you don't like the term Great Extinction, because you want people focused on prevention now, looking forward?
You know, it's you talk to ecologists, and at the end of the conversation, you want to go and throw yourself off a tall building. and we have a lot to learn from the medical profession. I mean, if you went to visit your doctor and she said, oh, you're going to die, well, you know, she'd be right. We all are going to die. But you go and visit the doctor because you hope that your doctors can, postpone that event for a bit. As a practical conservation biologist, I know things are bad, but what I spend my time doing is working out ways of saving species, of giving them a better future, giving people a better future who live in places where species are most vulnerable. So I like to focus on solutions. I like to focus on what we can do rather than to constantly bemoan all the bad things that are happening.
Well, let's get into some of what we can do. Part of the first step, I gather, is getting good information and tracking where species and their members are. Is new technology, mobile technology, helping us do that?
It is indeed. I mean, first of all, we're learning a lot about where species are, where we know them to be, and where we're discovering new ones. And there are parts of the world where we are discovering new species quite quickly. I was last in Madison, Wisconsin about a month ago when I was watching a young lady defend her PhD dissertation on describing new species of orchids from New Guinea. I was very nervous in that dissertation defense because that was my elder daughter. And Stephanie was finding a lot of new species of orchids in New Guinea. And we know that there are places around the world where there are still species to be discovered. One of the ways in which we can make that happen is with the most extraordinary device for studying biodiversity, and we call it a smartphone. I can take my smartphone, take a picture of a plant or an animal, and upload it to an app called iNaturalist, and there people can identify it. I did that a few years ago with a brightly colored orange frog that I found in the forests of coastal Brazil. I'm not a frog person, but I didn't know what it was. So I posted it on iNaturalist and asked the frog experts to identify it, and they said, we can't. It's probably a new species. but even for species that are known, millions of people, I mean literally millions of people around the world are curious. So, you know, you might photograph a plant and you might not have seen it before, and you get an identification, you get identification confirmed, and it might be, you know, a species that in the past has occurred further south in Wisconsin, but now has moved further north because of global warming. That kind of crowdsourced data can be hugely important in telling us where species are, sometimes where they are not, and that is the grist to the mill of making very practical conservation decisions. And that kind of technology has, you know, only been around a few years.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, about why that's of value. So someone takes a picture of a species, crowdsources it, figures out where it is. How does that ultimately help with conservation and species preservation?
Well, if I can plug a small organization that I run called Saving Species, www.savingspecies.org, one of the things that we do is to look at places around the world where we think the greatest number of species are at risk of extinction. We work in Madagascar and coastal Brazil and the northern Andes of Colombia. And when we recognize and identify the places where species are at greatest risk of extinction, we often find that they are fragmented habitats. Once upon a time, the forest might have been continuous, but now it's been broken into pieces. And the problem with forest fragments is that the species live there tend to go extinct very quickly. They often can't find suitable mates. It's sometimes no more complicated than that. So one of the things that we can do is we can reconnect those habitat fragments by buying up the intervening land and restoring it. And in coastal Brazil, that's what we've done. We've done that for a charismatic little monkey called a golden lion tamarin. And by raising money for a Brazilian NGO called the Golden Lion Tamarin Association, we've helped them buy the land, restore the land to forest, and now the tamarins can get from one forest patch to another and quite literally go forth and multiply. To be able to do that, we need to know precisely where to act. We need to know what the priorities should be, and that requires really good data on where species are.
We're talking with conservation ecologist Stuart Pym with the organization Saving Species, talking about a new paper on the high extinction rate of species here on the Earth, kicked into overdrive since humans showed up on the scene. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do we take extinction seriously enough as a state, a nation, as a species? Have you worked in conservation, wildlife conservation in Wisconsin or beyond? How has new technology changed the way you do things? Have you taken smartphone pictures and sent them to the DNR ever?
We're talking with Stuart Pym, lead author of a new study that finds species are becoming extinct at least 1,000 times faster than they did before humans started interfering with the natural course.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how quickly species are going extinct around the world? Thoughts or questions about what can be done about it? And we talked a little bit about the changing role of technology in helping conservationists know where members of these species are so they can take action. Have you done this? Have you helped, say, in Wisconsin, crowdsource information about various wildlife species here? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Stuart, I want to ask you about one area of conservation that is mentioned, that only 2% of the oceans have been set aside as sanctuaries, wildlife sanctuaries, for instance, where there would be no hunting allowed. Is that part of the problem when we look at species die off in the oceans?
Yes, and I'm so glad you asked that, because, you know, we really have not protected very much of the oceans. And the consequence of that has been massive overfishing of many marine resources. And that's particularly tragic because the oceans are a source of potential great wealth. So, you know, people love to fish. They don't want those fish to completely be eliminated. The collapse of cod fisheries off the Canadian Maritimes was an economic disaster. And our changing attitudes towards marine resources are important. I mean, a century ago, if we were talking about whaling, we'd be talking about going out and hunting whales. Now there are thriving whaling industries off Gloucester and Provincetown and the Canadian Maritimes, the Pacific Coast, out of Victoria, Canada, and people are hunting the whales with cameras. The size of the market for people who enjoy wildlife, who photograph it, who watch it, is enormous. It's a very, very significant piece of our economy. Many countries in the world have a lot of their income coming in from ecotourism, broadly defined. And for us to destroy, particularly the oceans, is to destroy something that could give us a sustainable harvest, could give us pleasure, could give us an industry based on tourism. All of those things are really good examples of why we need to protect more of the environment. And the fact that we protect so little of the oceans is really a problem.
Can that ecological tourism model, do you think, be applied in some of the sensitive areas you mentioned working in, coastal Brazil, Madagascar, and elsewhere?
Oh, very much so. I mean, a lot of Madagascar's income comes because people want to go and see lemurs. Lemurs are enormously engaging mammals, and people want to go and see them. I mean, it's not just the movie Madagascar. People realize that those lemurs are real, and they are just delightful to watch, and people spend money to go there.
But, Stuart, I'd worry that if I go there, I'm somehow doing something bad, stepping on something that a lemur is going to eat, and I'll do more harm than good with my presence there.
You know, there's always that risk, but you know, given the call, I would rather have people go there and enjoy the wildlife as I would in our own national parks. I mean, there are hundreds of millions of people visit our national parks every year, and I think that's a measure of how much we cherish those national parks and the biodiversity that occurs there.
And let's take a caller now. We've got Debbie on the line in Princeton. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What is your question?
Well, I was doing some research on the farm that we live on, and I found a state of Wisconsin map, and it put our property in the middle of a section that said that there were endangered species or protected species. And I'm wondering, how does one go about finding out what is being protected and what I can, what efforts I can make to maintain the species?
Thanks for the call, Debbie. Stuart, I don't know if you have Wisconsin-specific information, but generally about public awareness of what's in their own backyard.
Yeah, I can't speak to Wisconsin specifically, but generally, if there is an overlay that says there are endangered species there, you ought to be able to find what they are. And there's almost certainly some sort of management plan that will talk about how, how you can manage your land in order to protect it. The information's there. It might not be easy to find, but I'm sorry, I can't sort of come up with specific web locations. But generally, that information is there, and one can find somewhere what one needs to do.
Stuart, you were talking earlier about data collection and crowdsourcing and ways for sort of the world to connect with each other and gather resources and information about species, where they're moving, where they might need protection. And we know that the internet is hooking up the world. Are conservation groups as organized to handle this data? Are systems in place to use it effectively?
Yes. I mean, one of the lovely stories involving iNaturalist, this app, is there are tens of millions of bird watchers around the world, but there are not that many people who express a passion for frogs. And one of them was a sergeant serving in our military in Iraq. He goes into the latrine at the camp at his base, sees a frog, has no idea what it is, takes a photograph of it, and uploads it to iNaturalist, whereupon the frog experts of the world pronounce it a frog that had not been seen in that part of Iraq before. I find this a sort of a lovely story because it means that the people who are passionate about frogs can connect with each other, can discuss their ideas and what they know and what they're finding. And those observations then can be uploaded into global databases. A particular one is called the Global Biodiversity Information Facility. And those observations go to help us, you know, work out where species are, to know where species are, and to set appropriate priorities for management.
So we started off with some bad news and gloom and doom, the high rate of extinction for the species on this planet, thanks in large part, I guess, to us. It sounds like you are fairly optimistic that something can be done to, at the very least, slow that rate down.
Well, you know, watching The Wizard of Oz with my two daughters when they were growing up, and Dorothy says, "Oh, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, will there be wild things out there?" I think it would be an awful tragedy if the answer were no. And I think we're now in a position to be a lot smarter in terms of what we need to do and where we need to act.
Stuart, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely my pleasure.
We've been talking to Stuart Pym, Professor of Conservation Ecology at Duke University.
And you can find his website. I believe he said it was savingspecies.org, or a search for saving species will get you there, too.
Don't forget iNaturalist, another tool he mentioned quite a bit there. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out what the Dictionary of American Regional English is doing to update itself for a new generation.
But first, the Environmental Protection Agency announced new regulations today to cut power plants' carbon emissions by 30% by the year 2030.
Industry groups are pushing back, saying this could put some power companies out of business and damage the economy. The Obama administration says the change is needed to confront climate change, and incentives for new technology development could actually help stimulate the economy.
WPR reporter Chuck Cornbach joins us now from our Milwaukee studios. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Well, the EPA draft proposal today is part of what's seen as the centerpiece of Obama's climate change policy. What is in President Obama's proposal?
Well, again, there's about a nationwide average of about a 30% cut in carbon dioxide emissions from coal-burning power plants. Major contributor to climate change, say the scientists. And so going after the coal-burning power plants has been something that's been in the works for some time. It's been fought over in court, but yet the president has decided to move ahead with the proposal. And it would vary some from state to state. Wisconsin, though, would be about 33% cut target reduction from 2005 levels by the year 2030 or so. Again, there's some flexibility, some variability. And as the public comment period goes over the next 10 or 12 months, I bet there'll be some arguments over what the rate should be in Wisconsin if indeed the plan goes ahead.
Well, more than half the state's electricity comes from coal. We're 14th in the nation in coal use. Given that, does that mean that these new rules are going to be any more difficult for Wisconsin, say, than another state with lower coal use?
Well, again, a point of debate. I mean, the EPA is saying that there's flexibility for the states. No state is similar, and that there'd be some various ways to come up with this 30% roughly reduction. Things such as burning coal more efficiently, more use of renewable energy in the state. And, of course, there's been a growth of solar and wind power in Wisconsin and many other states. More utilities switching to natural gas, which is less of a greenhouse gas problem from natural gas, but certainly some. And more use of energy efficiency so that we're burning perhaps less coal to run certain projects, to run certain appliances and things like that. All sort of all hands on deck, all things sort of adding up, say the EPA and environmental groups that support it, that there will be flexibility.
And what is the response so far from Wisconsin utility companies?
Well, they haven't been saying a whole lot. Xcel out in the western part of the state has wanted some clarity, I think, and because they also are moving ahead in, on things like wind and so on. Governor Walker today in Milwaukee said that if it's really flexibility, then it's something that's potentially encouraging to him. He says that there have been promises not just from the Obama administration but others in the past saying we'll give you flexibility, and then the flexibility does not occur. But he says if it's real flexibility, there's a potential upside for the state. He says if Wisconsin can make green by going green, in other words, if there's ways this can stimulate the economy in a certain direction. He didn't exactly give a thumbs up just yet, but a cautious optimism about it. However, just a few months ago, the Walker administration did send the EPA a letter raising some concerns because we get so much electricity in the state from coal-fired power plants, and a lot of the state's economy is dependent on manufacturers who need a lot of electricity. Walker and others don't want electricity prices at these manufacturers to shoot up and cause headaches for the product makers.
And as I understand it, one question on the table in Wisconsin has been, will Wisconsin get credits for past energy reductions and emissions that we've apparently been incorporating over the past year or two? And is that going to count toward these standards?
Right. And that is, and it's probably more than a year or two. And also factor in that some of the reductions came about, as the NPR spot a moment ago said, through the recession. that there was less use of electricity by manufacturers because some went out of business or cut back and so on. And there was therefore some reduction in carbon dioxide emissions just because the economy was going sour for a while. So there's been some reductions via that. There's been some reductions by power plants getting rid of coal and changing to natural gas or putting in a big new collection, you know, ways to collect carbon dioxide emissions and not let as much out into the atmosphere, or burning coal more efficiently, sort of the all hands on deck approach I mentioned before. So yes, there'll be some debate over, well, we did this, don't we get credit for it? And it's not just, of course, President Obama that will have a role in deciding that, but the next president and the president perhaps beyond that.
Is there any word about whether Wisconsin could be involved in a cap and trade plan with credits the way other states are?
Well, I think there's some initial skepticism about that, but it has been the case in some other types of emissions. There's been cap and trade going on. And again, cap and trade is the idea of buying and selling of emissions credits, that companies that do well at reducing emissions might sell credits to companies that are having problems meeting reductions, with the overall goal of either limiting carbon dioxide emissions or hopefully, they would say, cutting carbon dioxide emissions. It's sort of a complex thing. I was listening to a conservative station today that was raising a big hue and cry about cap and trade. But it has worked to some degree, whether it can with carbon dioxide, which is such a prevalent type of pollution, devil in the details there.
And the letter, rather, that you referenced earlier that Governor Walker had sent regarding these emissions and the plan which was coming down the pipeline, the question that he raised was some legal issues, as he saw it, still out there in the field that needed to be dealt with. Where is that, do you think, right now as we look at these new emission standards?
Well, they sent the letter, but the EPA and White House went ahead with a plan today. So there's not every state concern is going to be listened to, but there may be court attempts by groups, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the coal industry, and others that don't like these reductions. If they take their arguments to court, they may incorporate some arguments from states like Wisconsin as to whether, as I say, whether this is doable, whether they would cause a large increase in electricity prices, and other sorts of ways that this would play out.
Now, President Obama hasn't acted on carbon emission standards at this level until now. Why did he pick this moment?
Well, there's been some national news reports that suggest he is trying to sort of make his mark on this issue before he leaves office. There's certainly, I think, the previous EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson did a lot of outreach to minority communities and talking about asthma, because this reductions would have not only carbon dioxide reductions, but there could be potentially gains in the slicing of other pollutants that lead to asthma and other breathing problems. And Jackson and Obama have been paying attention to the sort of side benefits, if you will, of better, more efficient burning of coal. But he's also, as I say, the president also been promising for a number of years to move ahead and has now done so. Perhaps is exerting more executive power than the Republicans would like, but again, trying to make a mark, before he leaves office, again, with the uncertainty of what would happen after he leaves office.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Chuck Kornbach, our WPR reporter based in Milwaukee.
In 1965, University of Wisconsin students and researchers set out in word wagons to record the ways Americans spoke in different parts of the country.
Now, nearly 50 years later, they're tracing how language uses change, substituting computers and online survey methods for those original wagons, all to update the Dictionary of American Regional English.
With us now is Joan Houston Hall. She's chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English and senior scientist of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's an expert on American English and all those regional and social variations. Joan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, let's start. About 50 years ago, we saw a photo of a couple of the original researchers standing next to the camper, the word wagon, collecting, like, documenting the way we talk. What did that tell us about American English and how it varied around the country?
Well, those field workers in their word wagons went to 1,002 communities across the country and asked people who had lived there all their lives to answer thousands of questions in a huge questionnaire. And what we discovered is that there were many, many regional patterns about the way people use words. Some showed that Wisconsinites use words that aren't heard elsewhere, and that's what we're trying to discover this time, whether those words are still characteristic of this area or whether they've changed.
So you said some words were characteristic of Wisconsin. What were the words that you were looking at 50 years ago?
Oh, we looked at words dealing with all parts of our lives, from time to weather to food, clothing, animals, farming, religion, health, disease, all sorts of things. And within all those categories, there were many different patterns. So for Wisconsin, words like flowage, for instance, we found to be characteristic only of Wisconsin. Now, if we do this new survey nationwide, we'll be really interested to see whether people in other parts of the U.S. have adopted that term.
Now, the bad news here is you're not gearing up for a big road trip. You're not going out in the word wagons this time around.
That's right. That was very expensive and very time-consuming. So this time, we're doing an online survey. We're working with the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, and we have put up the survey, which is available for Wisconsin residents to go to and answer questions as they like.
So is it up there right now, ready to go?
It is indeed, and you can get there easily just by going to the DARE site, which is www.dare.wisc.edu. And there is a button on the left side that says Online Wisconsin Survey.
It's fascinating stuff. So do you expect much to have changed? I imagine 50 years is a long time of language evolution.
It is a long time, and it's a very good question. One popular notion is that because we're a very mobile population and because we listen to many of the same media, our English has become, quote, homogenized. Mm-hmm. That's a popular notion, but I don't think it's true. Language changes, yes, of course, but it doesn't change at the same rates or in the same ways in all places. So what we're hoping to find is how homogenized our language has become. And I am quite convinced that we will still find many, many differences from one place in the country to another.
And it's not necessarily just a matter of did this regional word or phrase survive, but I would think that different regions are still inventing and coming up with new words that maybe start in one state or part of a state.
Yes, that's always true. We invent words as we need them. And many people think that commercial terms will take over for local food items, say. But if there's no reason to adopt a nationwide term, we're perfectly happy to hold on to the things that have been important to us all our lives.
Yeah, we have a lot of Wisconsin words. Bubbler is one that we associate with Wisconsin, at least southeastern Wisconsin for sure. And it seems as though those are still kicking around. Just anecdotally, are you seeing changes as you talk to people in the state and as you travel?
Well, bubbler is, of course, one that is very dear to the hearts of Wisconsinites. And certainly it's true that if you look at the United States, this is the heart of bubbler country. But it's not the only place where people use the term. There are places in Massachusetts and Rhode Island and in Portland, Oregon, where people talk about bubblers. But here it's especially strong and probably goes back to the Kohler Company in the early part of the 20th century when they marketed in the part of the country that now uses the term bubbler.
You're seeing, or you're in the midst of this internet survey, are you looking at results as they come in, or are you going to wait until you're all done and then start crunching the words?
We've looked just casually at the results, but we won't do any real analysis until we're done.
Off the top of your head, though, any fun stuff coming in or surprising or, you know, words that stuck around that we might not have expected to?
Well, I can't go that far yet.
Oh, okay.
What are some favorites from the past? Do you remember? I see you've got a list of words in front of you there.
Yeah, there are lots of food items that are very Wisconsin, or maybe Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. And that's natural, of course, because many of them reflect our ethnic heritage. So words like booyah, for instance, is very Wisconsin, and it's restricted within the state. Mm-hmm. To the area around, say, Appleton and east of there in small communities along the lake. Things like German potato salad, for instance, which people think is totally logical, is not something that is recognized elsewhere. And foreign terms like kolachki and kringle and krumkaka and lefse and punchki and lutefisk, of course. But even things like squeaky cheese. I had never heard of squeaky cheese, and I didn't know what cheese curds were. And although those have spread some in the last decades, I'm sure that they are still relatively regional. But in addition to food words, there are lots of others. The tradition of the golden birthday, for instance, is very Wisconsin.
Really? I don't think I'd ever heard of it before I moved here. So that makes sense. That hadn't occurred to me. That was a Wisconsin thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the supper club tradition, of course, is very Wisconsin. Terms like trunk roads, take County Trunk M. Hmm. That's a local term. And one of my favorites is the term winter potato. Do you know a winter potato?
Mm-mm. No.
A winter potato is a rounded rock that comes to the surface of a farmer's field in the winter as the ground thaws and freezes.
A winter potato. I like that.
So when you get your field ready in the spring, it might be crowded with winter potatoes, and that's not a good thing.
Only when they're out.
Okay.
Wow, it's so fun hearing these. I can't help but feeling that if these are gone now, it would be kind of sad to lose these words. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're lost, but we'll tell you in another year.
So in the later years of the project, the Regional English Project so far, some of the ones we were talking about just now came from ethnic groups, from farming talk. Are there new drivers of new regional words now? Food, I imagine, will always be, but any others?
Well, I'm sure that with the increasing numbers of Hispanic speakers, we will adopt new words that weren't part of our vocabulary before. Many of the other ethnic terms that still remain do reflect things like Norwegian heritage, with words like ish and ishi rather than ik and icky, and ufta, which is, of course, very Wisconsin and Minnesota. And card games are very reflective of our German heritage. Sheep's head, Schafskopf, Schmier, all of them very distinctive of this part of the country.
And you're looking at the country as a whole, right? So it's not just Wisconsin. And what about some of our neighbors? Do you recall any of the interesting words from, say, Illinois or Minnesota?
Well, in the early survey, we did do the whole country. Now we're concentrating only on Wisconsin because we hope to find out whether this online survey is workable in the whole country. But Minnesota has lots of interesting words, like the name for what we would call a rubber band. It's a rubber binder in Minnesota. And lots of other Norwegian food words are common there.
Well, we were just talking. I was talking to our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, both of us from Michigan, and we were talking about Coney dogs. And I was in a hot dog place in Madison a while back, and they had Coney sauce. And I asked the guy at the counter, "Are you from Michigan?" "No, but the owner is." So it's one of those things. These are words that when somebody says them, a lot of the time, you know where they're from. So if you run into somebody talking about bubblers elsewhere in the country, good chance they're from Wisconsin.
Yes, indeed. But on the other hand, if you go to O'Hare and ask somebody, where's the nearest bubbler? They're not likely to understand you.
And I was wondering if you could give people the website once more for people who want to take the survey before we run out of time.
Yes, www.dare.wisc.edu. Look for the button on the left-hand side.
Joan, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Joan Houston Hall, Chief Editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, Senior Scientist of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.